I think by far that the biggest thing is to really, really increase your knowledge base in absolutely every aspect of the sport.
The Triathlon Show 130. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael. I am still suffering from a bit of allergies or a cold, I don't know quite what, but yeah, my voice is still not recovered, so apologies for that. In addition, I am currently at a training camp that I host in the Algarve. We're having a ton of fun, fantastic cycling, but I don't have quite my usual podcasting setup. So if there are any issues with the audio here in the intro and outro, then that may be the reason. But it should all be good, and the interview was done at my usual setup. My guest today is David Nichols from the United Kingdom, but he lives in Moscow, and he qualified for the Ironman World Championships of this year in the Ironman South Africa race earlier this winter. And we will discuss that, how he did that, and in particular, how he got very precise. He got the details right. He did a lot of research. He listened to this podcast for one thing, and he applied these things, and that made a massive difference to how he performed, and he managed to get the most out of his training. He was time crunched. He didn't train as much as you would probably expect an age grouper in that age group category train to qualify for Kona, but he really, really got the most of his time investment, and that is the topic of today's interview. You will learn all about that and get the most important things that David learned, what were the major drivers of his success in today's interview. But first, big thank you to our sponsors, Precision Hydration. Precision Hydration make electrolyte products that keep you from losing too much electrolytes, sodium, potassium, and otherwise. When you go out and you train long, you train hard, you train in the heat, electrolytes are a big important part of the puzzle of endurance performance, and you need to get it right if you want to qualify for Kona. But even if you want to maybe complete your first Ironman, not being paying attention to things like nutrition, to electrolytes, that will derail your performance and put you at severe risk of not finishing your event. So go and check out Precision Hydration on precisionhydration.com, and you can get your first box of Precision Hydration electrolyte for free when you use the discount code ThatTriathlonShow, all one word, at checkout. And again, that's precisionhydration.com. All right, now let's go right into the interview with David Nichols and this age group case study on qualifying for Kona. All right, so today's guest on That Triathlon Show is David Nichols. This is another age group case study. So David, very welcome to the show. It's great that we finally get to talk.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and your triathlon background.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a 30-year-old British guy actually living in Moscow, Russia for the last 4 years. I live with my wife and a one-year-old child here. In terms of triathlon background, I first triathlon was actually at university well over 10 years ago. I did Ironman Nice after basically getting a bit bored of rowing that I was doing for a few years before that. But that was pretty chilled, you know, it was a sort of 11:50, very relaxed, very enjoyable race. But then unfortunately after that, I joined the sort of finance world and worked 60, 80-hour weeks for a few years. And only recently have I had a bit more free time and decided to come back to it. And then over the last few years, decided to have a crack at Kona.
And so that's what you've done. You just qualified for Kona at Ironman South Africa. So when did you decide to give Kona a crack and try to qualify?
Yeah, sure. So it was really over the last, I've had the feeling for the last couple of years that probably I would be able to give it a go, because I've done a few sort of local triathlons and things with not much consistent training, and managed to achieve like top 20 results or something. And the same with ultra marathons and other sort of racing I've done. So I've had the feeling that I probably would be able to get there. And so as I, when I found out I was going to have my first child, I decided that would probably be, that was probably a pretty good incentive to actually get it done sooner rather than later. So yeah, I set myself in 2017, I had some intermediate targets, which was a sub 4:30 half Ironman and a 3-hour marathon. And I did both of those basically. So I then decided I picked the race that I thought would suit me best and suit my timing and went for it really hard from, I guess, December last year.
And in those years before, when you were training not consistently but still doing some racing, how exactly did you train? Do you have any idea what your average weekly or monthly training volume would be?
Yeah, it's really volatile. I think I was like any standard, like, middle of the pack / back of front of the pack age group, where you basically just train based on how much free time you have and what your social plans are. So maybe in the winter I'd be doing 8 to 10 hours a week at best, but then in the summer it would go down due to sort of holidays and traveling and things. So very, very patchy, and usually sort of 2 months leading up to a big race, say, but obviously they weren't that important for me, but yeah, I'd do a bit more, and then I'd completely do nothing for a couple, almost nothing for a couple of months. That sort of thing.
Yeah, that sounds very, very typical. But in 2017, then you got the consistency. When exactly did you get consistent, and how did your training then change?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, it was a slow process, right? So for my first goal was this half Ironman that I wanted to get a good time to show I was sort of on track for Kona. And that was sort of the start of getting this consistency, but the volume was still relatively low. So sort of maximum 10 hours a week, I think, because I had a young child. But then it really, really kicked off in December. And from December until April, I was doing, I averaged 16 hours a week. But thanks to a few sort of 20, 22 hour weeks when my wife was away, all my parents could come and help look after the baby.
Yeah, but that's still not for qualifying for Kona. It's something that sounds within the realm of possibility for a lot of people that have that dream. So that I think can give people some hope that you don't need to do consistent 25-hour weeks to qualify for Kona.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the one of my main learning points from it was it's actually a lot more though than that, those training hours, right? It's the core, it's the stretching, it's the making sure nutrition's absolutely on point, it's making sure you sleep enough, it's the obsessing about your bike and stuff like that, and that does take a bit of time as well. So I think that was one of my biggest surprises, that actually it's a lot more than that. But I absolutely agree that it's doable for most people. I think it's just a question of how much you can commit over what time, depending on your fitness.
So when you were doing this training, you had a young child, a young son, and you're working in finance still, but how much are you working? So kind of give us an idea of what a typical day in the middle of the week might look like for you.
Yeah, sure. So it was, I mean, always early starts, obviously, and luckily my son helped that because he tended to wake up quite early. So always at least one training session before work, sometimes two. On my Thursdays, for example, would be an early swim, starting at 7, and then I swim with a master's group till 8:30. Then I put on my running shoes and straight away do a 40-minute to an hour run. Then go straight to work, get back from work at about 7, have an hour with my kid eating and doing a bath and stuff, and then I do maybe an hour and a half bike. That would be a standard Thursday for me.
I guess you probably, or I know because I read your race report from South Africa, you did a lot of bike training on the indoor trainer.
Yeah, I live in Moscow, so it wasn't really an option to train outside. But actually, I think even without that, I would have done all my training on the indoor trainer. I think it's just spectacularly effective. Particularly as I did the Trainer Road program pretty religiously, and it just unbelievably effective. I've done it actually over the last year and a half. I've followed some sort of Trainer Road program, and just the gains I've seen were absolutely incredible, especially compared to my friends who are doing a lot of riding, but not as much in a structured way. So I think that's a really key part of my success And especially as indoors, you can work on the aero position, which again is something I see that my peers don't quite have as well as I do, because they do a lot of riding outside, where it's hard to stay really aero for a consistent amount of time.
Yeah. But that's really good. And that structure that you get, the return on time invested is so much higher when you have the structure and trainer road. You probably know, because you listen to the podcast, that I'm also myself a very, very big fan of trainer road, and a lot of the athletes that I coach are on it. And although I must say that these days I do most of my training outdoors, because it's just so fantastic here in Portugal and having a bit more flexibility, that that's where I'm right now. But I still am a very strong believer in how great that that software is for getting quality training done.
Yeah.
What about the structure of your training, if we talk about the swim and the run, starting with the swim maybe? You mentioned master's classes. Can you go a little bit into detail on that?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's a good way to see how you approach the whole like Kona qualifying versus just doing triathlons, right? I've always been a decent swimmer. I think my PB before was 105 and 31 minutes and a half. So that's a decent swimmer. But I realized there were two things: that I needed to swim much more consistently and improve my technique. So I think probably the biggest gains came from getting the best swim coach I could possibly find, and having maybe one lesson with him every 2 weeks, where it was only 45 minutes, but he'd give me one thing that I need to focus on over the next 2 weeks of swimming, and then just really, really focusing on that. And that completely changed my stroke, I think. And then, yeah, apart from that, as I said, yeah, I did a master's group, which was just for me the only way to do, you know, 4K swim sessions with some really real quality intensity, because obviously when you're racing other people, you can push yourself so much harder. Like I found consistently when I went to the pool on my own, my sessions would be shorter, less quality, or with longer breaks and things. So yeah, couldn't emphasize the value of the master's program enough.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely spot on there. You find an extra gear in you that you didn't know you have in the pool. It's so difficult, even though you think you may be pushing yourself to the max when you're on your own. It's not quite the max that you can achieve when you're with others.
And yeah, 100%. Yeah.
With a coach, can you give us a couple of, this is obviously very personal, individual for you, but just to give somebody an idea what you might get out of having a swim coach to give you individual tips, what were like the main couple or two or three changes that you made to your stroke after getting the tips from the coach?
Yeah, sure. So I think absolutely the main one is sort of I guess it's kind of catch combined with how you move your arms through the water. And what we focused a lot on, which I found definitely the most helpful thing, I think, is we used swim bands for at least 10 minutes before every coach session. And then I use them, I guess, before every session I do at least 10 minutes of swim band work, which I guess you know what I'm talking about. It's basically elastic that has some sort of paddle attached to it. And that helps you really isolate that sort of early vertical forearm, I guess you could call it, but that's a bit controversial. But then, so you're actually pushing water back rather than down. And I think that was by far the biggest change I had, that feeling of just being able to push the water straight back, because you get the elbow down and then push back. And that was also massively aided by using a snorkel, because then I could actually see what my hands were doing much better. And that was when I noticed myself going drastically faster in the water.
Brilliant. How do you structure that band work before? Is it all about just figuring out the exact movement pattern, or do you also do it to get muscular endurance, to work with quite some resistance, or how does that work?
Yeah, so before swim sessions, it would typically be to sort of really isolate that movement pattern. So I start to do, well, I guess I've built it up over time, but when I was starting, I was doing maybe 2 times 20 of each side, of just moving the sort of the forearm down to that 90 degree position. And then when you've done that, you continue that to move your arm all the way back. But then obviously sometimes, and my coach would have rather I did it more when I was not swimming, on days I wasn't swimming, I just use the swim band and do some much harder work. And I felt that was also, yeah, very useful, because it is very swim specific muscles that I was building.
Yeah, absolutely. I use them myself as well. I don't do it before swim workouts. We have another warm up routine, but I'm also a big fan of them. And especially like for athletes that have a big travel coming up, for example, I usually tell them to, hey, get these Finis stretch cords for like 30 euros on Amazon, and then you can maintain quite a lot of what you would otherwise lose if you were just out of the pool for 2 weeks.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about the run then? How did you structure that?
Yeah, the run. So I think that my focus on running was two things. It was really the biomechanical part, and it's and I mean, as you know better than anyone, right? It's not technique, but it's making sure you have the right sort of core muscle strength to actually run properly and efficiently. And I'd self-diagnosed that I had actually, well, like everyone that sits in an office chair for what, 8-10 hours a day, I had very weak core, glute med, glute max. And so a lot of my work was focused on strengthening those and then doing a lot of drills. So after at least 3 runs a week, I would do maybe 5-10 minutes of drills, so strides and the sort of typical running drills. And I felt that really helped my run. And just looking at race pictures compared to race pictures before, you can see that my sort of whole body is straight rather than sort of crooked to one side like it used to be. So that clearly helped. And I wasn't injured at all. The other thing that I focused on was just really, really high frequency of running. I think it's, you know, if any readers of Slow Twitch, it's called the Barry P program, which is very popular. The idea being that it's rather than doing a huge amount of intensity, that the idea is just to first run as often as you can to build up that sort of resilience in your legs. And only when you're feeling really like you've got that, then to add some intensity. But definitely the very large majority of my runs were at easy pace. And easy pace checked with running calculator. So as an example, I do a 3-hour marathon and I was doing 5-minute kilometers.
Yeah, no, that sounds exactly right. I was going to say that I was very impressed when I read that in your report as well about the doing the drills 3 to 4 times per week after your runs. That's something that it shows the dedication to detail and attention to detail that you had throughout this process that you already mentioned a bit with the bike setup and all these other things, core strength and that can it. Kind of, it comes down to the fact that you need to establish what are your main limiters and what's the low hanging fruit for you. Where can you get the most return on investment for your time spent? And if you could do 10 minutes to improve your running form and make sure that you could maintain that for the duration of an Ironman marathon, then that would be probably a much better return on investment rather than doing 10 minutes of additional normal running compared to at the style that you were used to running and maybe not focusing as much on form and letting it slip as you got more tired. Is that what would you say? That's a correct assessment of how you were thinking?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, and I really felt it did actually benefit. So, yeah.
Good. And so, what about the running volume? How much volume did you get up to?
Yeah, I think it wasn't absolutely enormous volume. It was, I think my biggest week was just over 60K. So that's not huge volume at all, in fact, for Ironman racing. But my biggest constraint was, I guess, time. And that was the biggest constraint.
Yeah, and you also, you had a nice chart in the race report again, referring to that time and time again, that you, even though your pace faded towards the end of the South Africa Ironman marathon, you still faded much less and had much better splits in the last 10K compared to the other top age groupers in your age group. So that definitely is proof in the pudding that you did something right on the run there to be able to...
Well, I think, yeah, that combined with being a strong cyclist and as well as a decent weights program, I think, and it's so key. I think maybe just very quickly on weights. I think the cleverest thing I've heard is that why do you slow down in an Ironman marathon? You slow down because your muscles are just tired, right? You don't have the strength to go faster. And so I really, really believe the weights is incredibly important. And I actually wish with hindsight, I would have done more. And actually with my Kona build, I'm already starting to do a really high quality weights program from now, because I think it's super important and it's something that people don't do enough.
How much did you do and what are you planning to do now? Or let's say, what's the structure of it? Is it what would a workout look like in the gym?
Sure. So I followed the Joe Friel basically approach for my base phase, which was 2 times a week with very high weight, like you discussed, really. So high weight, low reps, 4 or 5 exercise, not varying that much between sessions, actually. And just gradually pushing up the weight a bit. But however, what I regret is that when I started entering my build phase, I basically stopped weight training just due to lack of time. And I listening to your podcast and also thinking about it, I definitely will keep that up throughout the build phase next time.
Yeah, that's something that I'm in kind of that phase myself now, and I try to maintain at least every 10 days do one weight session. It doesn't have to be as big as they were when I was building strength, but to maintain at least every 10 days, ideally every 7 days, yep. Do something and maybe reduce to 2 sets instead of 3, and you might not need to go to quite the same. You can do 80% of one rep max instead of 85, but getting close, and then you won't be as sore, but you will maintain the strength that you build. So that's an important observation that you did there. And regarding that your muscles are what gives up on you and not your heart and lungs, yeah, I absolutely agree 100%. And I know that you also, for the nutrition side of things, you followed the Jesse Kropelnicki protocols a lot. And one thing that he talks about is how hiking is fantastic for Ironman training, because just being on your feet for a long, 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 long time, and that is fantastic for the Ironman marathon in the end.
Yeah, probably.
So let's talk a little bit about your nutrition, because that's one of the things that you mentioned as key. So what did it look like before, and what did you change when you got serious about qualifying?
Yeah, sure. So I'm again quite typical of a sort of middle of the pack guy, whereas I felt that I ate quite healthily before, because in the fact that I didn't have much junk food, I haven't drunk at all for 4 or 5 years. So but actually looking back on it, it was a lot of white carbs, there's a lot of pasta, and relatively little fruit or veg, right? And I think, again, like most people, I just couldn't really conceptualize how you could eat enough while not just eating pasta, basically, or rice. So the real game changer for me was firstly listening to your Jesse Kropelnicki podcast and reading his book, which sort of goes into how important it is. But then secondly, and this is a really thing I'd really emphasize to everyone, is go on YouTube and Google like a swimmer's diet or a day in the life of the Olympic swimmer, and you'll see there that it's you can see what Olympic athletes eat, and it is really high quality food. It's so much food and veg, it's eggs, it's lentils and stuff like that, and actually they do get by with burning thousands of calories a day with relatively little pasta and things, and so that's basically then what I followed since December pretty religiously, actually. And I really believe it helped, because I was amazed how much training I could do and how much training stress I could take without really feeling too bad, actually. Apart from maybe, my really big weeks, I was just, on the turbo in amazement, looking at the numbers I could push out after, say, like the Tuesday of a VO2 max session after a really hard weekend. And I really believe it's due to this. It can only be really due to this nutrition change, because I've always slept quite well. So it's a super important thing.
Yeah, that's fantastic to hear how big a change that made, or how big an impact it clearly did for you. What about your race nutrition, and how did you approach that, and how did you approach it in training?
Yeah, sure. So that was the other big takeaway from this Kropelnicki podcast that again changed my life. And actually, nutrition, looking back at racing I've done, has been by far the biggest limiter for me in basically all races, in fact. Maybe I'm not blessed with good genes or just haven't really thought through it. So I got my Excel spreadsheet out, right? I used the ratios the Jesse Kropelnicki book and endurance cookbook is just super, super specific on how many carbs per hour you should take and how many grams of salt and things. And so I got my Excel sheet, worked out how many I should have. And then in training, I for all my long rides, I did that or even above that to train my body to take in the right amount of, to make sure I could take in the right amount of carbs. And actually it clearly worked, because, I was having 100 grams of carbs on the bike, which is quite a lot, right? It's more than you potentially would hear recommended. And the reason due to that is because I trained every single long ride I did. I was making sure I had exactly my race nutrition.
How many workouts, or like what workouts did you practice your race nutrition? Did you do, because Jesse said when I interviewed him, which was the one thing that I think is a bit weird, he said in every single workout. So I understood that to mean even just the easy 1 hour workouts. And that's the one thing that potentially personally I would not necessarily agree with. But did you do that, or did you choose the longer and harder workouts, or how did you approach it?
Yeah, so I think Broadly, yes, every single workout. I think the ones I wouldn't do it for would be the early morning runs, where I was specifically doing it in a fasted state, particularly in the base phase, because I really think there's a lot of benefit from that in itself. But for the bike, I'd always have a liter of sports drink, for example, during even an hour bike, and partly because I was doing it inside, so I was sweating a lot. But also I really wanted to make sure that I was sort of training my gut. Going forward, maybe I wouldn't need to be quite so aggressive in terms of eating all those gels and gels and drink a week, because obviously it's not very good for your teeth or your body. But I think I'm glad that I did it, to the extent that it's the first race I've ever done where I felt that, you know, every gram of fitness I had was fully expressed because my nutrition was so on point.
Yeah, and on the other hand, even if it's a shorter, slightly easier workout, or not necessarily a super long and taxing one, potentially that's what helped you have such a great nutrition in the rest of your life, that you that you weren't underfueled and entering athletic starvation, as it's sometimes called, because you didn't fuel in your workouts. You were already ready after the workout with some energy in your body. You never really ran out of all your glycogen. So that maybe could have helped with keeping the overall quality of your nutrition really high. I'm just speculating here, yeah. but that...
No, I actually 100% think that's the case, in fact. I found that, yeah, whenever I didn't fuel properly during a workout, all throughout the day, you're really hungry and you're desperate to have those, yeah, simple sugars, right? So I know, I definitely think that is the case, yeah.
Was there anything in the race itself that you had as a race strategy or race tactic or something you did that that was successful that you think that helped you qualify?
I don't think so, really. I think most once you've got to the race, it's just about executing exactly what your numbers are, right? And you race to your numbers and don't get too excited. If it helps, yeah. My watts for my bike, I was the target was around 215 watts, but I was very, very sure that I wasn't going to spike over 270 watts in any situation. And I think that's something that you see a lot of athletes do, is when there's hills, you go well above your FTP, and that ends up, you're burning too many matches, right?
What percentage of your FTP did you have as your target?
Around 65 or 66, and that's quite conservative. You see in,
yeah, sort for, of, for an advanced athlete, that's very conservative, I would say.
Yeah, you see 75 and things, but I think partly my FTP was slightly inflated. I just got too good at doing FTP tests, right? And I could just absolutely kill myself for 20 minutes. And I don't think 95% of that was reflective of what my true sort of hour power would be. And then secondly, yeah, I was going to make, I wanted to get a certain time rather than podium, right? And say if I was trying to podium, I'd probably would have pushed it a bit more and just rolled the dice. But because luckily I chose a championship race where there were nine slots on offer, I knew that I had to get around 9:25, and so that's, I was going for sort of no much more than that, basically. So a relatively conservative approach.
How did you approach pacing on the run?
Absolutely major thing is just not go out too hard, right? Just screaming at myself for the first 10K is don't run too hard, because it feels so easy, and especially as you're not even running your marathon pace, right? You're running your Ironman marathon pace. So just looking at the watch as much as I could, and just always holding myself back. As you mentioned earlier, I think that really worked, because in the last 10K, I was put a lot of time into my competitors and everyone around me. So I think that seemed to have paid off.
So you ended up finishing with, if you can give us the splits and the overall time and your position in your age group that made you qualify.
Yeah, sure. So I was 9:28 overall. And 9:26, what am I talking about? But my swim was 57 minutes, which was much, much more impressive than I expected. My bike was 5:06, whereas my plan was 5 hours. And then my run was 3:18.
And so for age groupers that are, they have as a dream to or a goal to qualify for Kona, what tips would you give them? What advice, what made the biggest differences for you that you also think could benefit other listeners if they want to go the same route?
Yeah, sure. So I think by far that the biggest thing is to really, really increase your knowledge base in absolutely every aspect of the sport, right? And it's such a multifaceted sport. You have to think about nutrition, about biomechanics, about core strength, about bike aerodynamics, about bike position, and there's just so many aspects of the sport. And I think this especially applies to people that are coached, because I have quite a lot of friends that are the coach, and they tend to just assume that because their coach will get them to Kona, but really the training is quite a small part of it. And especially the training prescription is all about execution of training, right? And so I think you really need to understand every single aspect and how they interact so you can really make sure that you're doing every single thing possible. And then the second sort of stage of that is to really apply that knowledge and be self-critical. So every week I'd look back at my training and my week and really say, right, what could I have done better this week? You know, did I really do my 3 times 15 minutes of quality core work? Was that long bike really in a proper aero position with my shoulders tucked and my head really nice and low? Did I do the proper amount of salt in my race nutrition training and stuff like that? And it's that sort of really analytical approach that seems to have really worked for me. And I think probably the reason why I managed to qualify in relatively little training.
Yeah, I love that self-reflection piece there, looking back at what you've done and what you could have done better. That's definitely a great, fantastic way to keep having that compound effect for you being in finance to keep improving and adding on top of what you're already doing and accelerating that improvement, even though you're getting more advanced potentially. So that's brilliant advice. What about time management? How did you manage all of that and fitting it in with a family and work?
Yeah, I think that's the golden question, right? And the easy answers are things like you train in the morning or you do your training on the turbo. But I think it's good to be honest, right? And not sugarcoat it. It's really brutal. Especially the 2 months before Ironman to do these 16 to 20 hour weeks and all the other stuff while with the family. And so really the main sort of advice or reason I think I was successful in managing to do all this training is just be really honest with both myself and my family quite how much it would require, right? And like but at the same time how much I wanted it and how much I would need to do in order to achieve this success. And so and sort of related to that is this idea of, for me, the idea of periodization is the fact that the closer you get to the race, the more serious you come and the more hours you do. And so the fact that my family understood that and understood that those 2 months particularly would be incredibly intense, and I would have to be increasingly selfish in terms of what I eat, when I slept, how much training when I trained and things. But after the race, that would completely reverse, and that I'd be, you know, 100% at their mercy in all ways. And that's how I got through it, I think, combined with a very understanding family, of course.
Brilliant. So for Kona now, are you back in training now and starting to build towards Kona?
I am, yeah, but I've promised the wife that it's not going to be a big one. You know, I was never going to be anywhere near podium in Kona. You know, I was ninth out of nine slots for my age group, and people beat me by 30 minutes. So for Kona, the plan is just to maintain fitness, do a bit more strength and conditioning, do some sort of heat acclimation type stuff, and go and just really enjoy it. I think an intense amount of work to get here. So yeah.
Will the heat acclimation and changing the strength training do a bit more of that? Will those be the changes that you make, or additions to what you've already done? Maybe training less, as you said, but the things that you want to improve, if we compare the South Africa build to the build that you'll have for Kona, will those be that too?
Absolutely, yeah. I think I'll move the swim training a bit more to focus on the sort of the core and the body position, because obviously it's a non-wetsuit swim, and my pool times are 10 seconds slower than my wetsuit open water time. So it's clear that I have a lot of work to do there. But apart from that, yeah, it's definitely weights and heat acclimation.
Okay. So I think that's about it before we move into the rapid fire questions, unless you have something that you can think of that we should talk about still, and maybe any tips that you have for age groupers in general, whether it's Kona qualifiers or not. If you have something, then feel free to chime in with that.
I think one of the things I actually wanted to mention that I found most interesting was that and this is Jesse Kropelnicki also mentioned this, but if you look at some of the sports nutrition projects products, there's just nowhere near enough salt for what the normal body needs. And so you might think you're having the right amount of gels, and so that's okay, but it's really not. And so that's the thing I think that I changed, and probably the biggest change to my nutrition, and one of the biggest reasons for my success accordingly, is that I significantly increased the amount of salt in, because I was using gels that didn't have enough in.
Yeah. And as you know, Precision Hydration is the sponsor of this podcast. So there people can go and take a free online sweat test and learn how much they really need, whatever product they end up using that gives them a ballpark number for how much sodium you should take in your training and racing. So that's a good resource to look at. Okay, so rapid fire questions. You know how this works. What's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to triathlon?
Yeah, sure. So it's all podcasts, I think. I mean, this one is probably my favorite one, or definitely the one that taught me the most. But also Trainer Road, of course, Tower 26, and finally the Kona Edge, because I think it's also helpful to hear age groupers being interviewed and hear what they've done, because obviously it's really nice to hear it from people that are in your position.
Great, and thank you very much. What's your favorite piece of gear or equipment?
Power meter and computer with Trainer Road, I think.
And what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Curiosity combined with the ability to be very self-critical.
Yeah, it shows. And that's something that I really admire. And I also, it was several times when I was reading your race report, I just had to pause and think, hey, this is a really, really excellent approach to everything. So David, I want to congratulate you. It's really amazing that on a relatively small amount of training for Kona qualifiers that you managed to do that, and especially not only considering your build, but actually the fact that up until a couple of years ago, you were very inconsistent and don't have the big base. So it takes a lot then to go and suddenly be consistent and qualify for Kona through that. So that's a fantastic achievement and worth congratulating.
Thank you very much.
All right. So that's about it for this interview. And we'll definitely have more age group case studies in the future, because I got a lot of great feedback from the first ones that we've had. So this one was more about Kona qualifying. Definitely send me emails to michael@scientifictriathlon.com with suggestions for what kind of profiles you want. And if you yourself want to be interviewed, then you can also let me know about that. It doesn't matter if you're a complete beginner or a super advanced age grouper. Everything is welcome, because we all are at different levels at different times. So yeah, get in touch if you want to be on the show. All right, there you have it. I really hope that you enjoyed that episode. I definitely enjoyed talking to David and learning about what made him successful, what changes he made, what the big drivers for his success were. Because I think that many of the things that he mentioned, they apply to so many other age groupers as well. So for me as a coach, for example, it is really helpful to learn about these things, what changes David needed to make and what changes were the most important to make in order to make the next steps of improvement and to be able to qualify for Kona the way he did on quite a small amount of training, as I said, compared to most age groupers in that category qualifying. It is very impressive, and I want to congratulate David once again. And thank you, David, for coming on and sharing your story. I really, really think this will be a hit. And yeah, it's super helpful for other age groupers to hear. Whether they want to qualify for Kona or not, many of the things we talked about are things that they will be able to apply and improve as triathletes as a consequence. So big thanks to David for that. In the next episode of That Triathlon Show, I will interview Ryan Cooper, who is the founder of Best Bike Split. And we will talk about bike pacing, optimal bike pacing. How do you pace your hills, for example, in a race? How much should you increase your power, if at all? How variable can your power profile be, or your effort in general, if you don't use power meters? How should you handle winds? How should you think about all sorts of things that relate to pacing and getting the most out of your bike split
at the same time allowing you to perform a successful run after that. So we'll get into some specific numbers and stuff, and it is all really, really good and useful information, especially now that race season is here. So this will be a useful one. Definitely listen to that. And since I'm here in the Algarve on my training camp, I haven't really promoted my last few episodes because I've been busy coaching and training myself. So the last episodes that I did with Professor Paul Larson on interval training, they are absolutely amazing in my opinion. One of the most interesting interviews that I've done. I'm not saying that the episodes are amazing, but Paul's knowledge is amazing. So, and the takeaways that you can get from that. So definitely, if you missed them because I didn't post on Facebook or anything, then I might do that later. But if you missed it, they're already out. Go and check the That Triathlon Show feed, and it's their episodes 128 and 29. Go and check those out. And if you're new to the show, go and check through all of the archives. There's so many great episodes that you may not have listened to. And subscribe so that you get all the episodes coming out in the future. But do go and check those archives and see what you may be interested in listening to that you haven't heard yet. So that's about it for this episode. Thank you so much to Precision Hydration for sponsoring this episode. Remember that Precision Hydration has a free online sweat test on their website that you can take to find out how much sodium you lose in your sweat. This will then give you a number of how much you should drink and with what electrolyte content in your drinks. So if you use Precision Hydration products, it is very easy. You can just apply their products as specified and that will be it. You're all set and good to go. But the point with this online sweat test is that in a few quick minutes for free, you can find out how you individually sweat and what your sweat sodium content is like. And when most sports drinks and gels, they assume a certain sodium content and sweat loss and do a one-size-fits-all strategy for adding sodium to their products, this doesn't really work because the individual variance is so, so big. So if you want to be detailed about things like David was and do things right and get the most out of your time invested in training when you come and show up at race day, then you need to find out your sweat rate, and you can do that on precisionhydration.com using the free online sweat test, which I also linked to in the episode description. Of course, if you buy any of their products, use the discount code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps, at checkout, and you'll get your first box for free. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.